Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Zastrzewski. Thanks for being with us on the show today. In studio with me is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennison. If you've got a question for him during our next half hour, you can phone that in to area code 765-496-1999. You can email it to ask@wbaa.org. And you can tweet it at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, sorry to miss you last month. Sarah Fenton did a nice job
Sarah
here.
Sarah did a great job.
But good to see you again. Thanks for being here as always.
Hey, how you doing, Stan?
Pretty good. I have to tell you, my first question this week comes from a listener, but not from a traditional listener. Mm-hmm. Indeed, from my 4.5-year-old daughter, Eleanor, who, as we were driving in the car on the way to daycare a few days ago, she asked me, "Daddy, why are they fixing this road? It looks just fine to me." And this was U.S. 52 just north and west of Northwestern Avenue there where they kind of merge.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to answer her question. Why are they working on that?
Well, you know, if it's 52, it's an NDOT thing. So I'll go ahead and give her the phone number of the NDOT commissioner and she can ask her. No, I'm just teasing.
That will be a fantastic conversation.
I know. I bet it would.
She's mature for her age. You should,
well,
you should hear her talk to
them. By virtue of her asking that question,
I now need
obvious.
To get Brandi Hendrickson on the phone with Eleanor. So we're going to try and do that.
You should do that. We get a lot of questions. We had a group of sixth graders in at the last council meeting. We were trying to get the firefly to be the state insect.
And we've covered that story. People can find that online at our website.
Good stuff. Anyway, the questions that they ask prior to getting in front of the council is amazing. They ask, "Mayor, how come you wear a suit? Mayor, why do you dress that way? How tall are you?" Their focus is on what's right in front of them. So Eleanor's questions about the road is relevant, but the answer isn't necessarily going to fit that ask kind of assessment.
Are you
tool.
About to dodge a 4.5-year-old's question?
No, I'm going to answer it specifically. It's what they call, they're doing some resurfacing work, and then they're also going to start working on the bridge deck. They're going to be doing on the both bridges, the east and west portions of the bridge. They're going to be changed. They're fixing the decking. The structure is fine, but they're just going to change over the decking. But in order to do that, they've got to get things done so that they can get the traffic to transition to the north side and then back to the south side on that crossing. So they're digging up the green space. They're getting ready to lay some asphalt so that they'll cross the traffic over. Then they'll go to that particular span, fix the one span, then transition it back. So in order to do that, they've got to put up a bunch of barrels. They've got to go ahead and get the equipment out there. They've got to do some bank stabilization so then when they start the actual project in earnest, that the tractors and the cranes and things won't slide down the embankment into the Wabash. So it's a great big pre-thing for an eventual thing that'll be basically making the bridges safer.
So let me ask, do you
guys... Did I answer that good enough for...
Yes, but now you're going to get the harder question from...
Oh, from you.
From the old guy. So you guys in Greater Lafayette this summer have a preponderance of orange traffic cones.
Yeah.
They are multiplying, it seems. So I wonder, does the city have any ability to say to NDOT, would you please not do this now when every other doggone road seems to be snarled by construction?
We do. But the unfortunate, I guess, negative result of that would be then you get put on the bottom of the list again. So believe it or not, the three governmental entities oftentimes, you know, talk to each other and we do strategize on how to make these things work. And our engineers talk all the time. And we do try to make sure that it's going to be the most positive inconvenience that you could ever have. We try and lay it out.
I am positively inconvenienced.
Oh, absolutely. I can tell. We try and lay it out so that there are different ways to get around town. But it's almost that Band-Aid, you know, pulling off the Band-Aid analogy. Do we get it done when we can? Do we get as much done as we can that the construction season will allow? When it comes to getting your contracts in and getting all the bids in, there's a timeline involved with that. And the revenue stream is critically important too. So we try to do what we can do, the best way that we can do it, and the most efficient way that we can do it. City of Lafayette does the same thing. If you talk to Mayor Wozworski, he'll tell you the exact same thing. The state also has, they've got a fiscal plan, they've got an action plan, they've got a way to get their things done also. For some reason or another, here in Tippecanoe County, we've been getting a lot of attention from the state. So we're going to take advantage of that positive relationship now and get as much of our, you know, road mileage fixed as we can. Bridges are a different story. You know, the bridges are certain things, certain components of the bridges we take care of, or the county government takes care of, and then the state takes care of. And with bridge construction, regardless of when you do it, it's going to be incredibly inconvenient.
Speaking of that, by the way, what are you hearing, if anything, from constituents about this proposal for a major bridge tax?
Not that much. In all honesty, because of property tax caps and other things, it really doesn't affect the city of West Lafayette that much. When we look at our overall general fund, it might take about 30 grand from us. And the fact of the matter is that the logic behind it is pretty sound. You know, we've learned from the state what happens when you don't take care of bridges. They break and they create huge problems. So, you know, we've got, I think it's 100 or more bridges within Tippecanoe County, and they all need to be at some point in time in their lifespan maintained. And this is just a way to keep up with the cost of doing business in bridge repair.
Well, you mentioned the amount of money it would take from the city, but we're talking more about what it would take from property taxpayers.
Correct, correct.
And so is this something that you think people are going to be amenable to paying extra for?
Well, I can't predict, you know, the general mindset of everybody, but I've had people that understand the logic behind it. I've not had anybody express a great deal of anger about it. They seem to be fairly willing to accept the reality that, you know, taking care of your stuff costs money, and once that fund dries up a little bit, then there needs to be a way to replenish it.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can send in your phone calls or your emails or your tweets with questions for him today. I've got one here from Michael, who writes, I'm a West Lafayette resident and have enjoyed Celery Bog for biking, walking, jogging, and nature programs. He says there's vacant land just west of it and south of Cumberland Road, including the hill formed by construction of the 231 bypass, which could be used as an extension of Celery Bog to serve future recreation. Mm-hmm. A power line runs north-south through the property. The frontage along Cumberland could be left open, he says, to future development. I'm not sure of the ownership of the property, Michael says, but it could connect Celery Bog to the trail system along Cumberland Road. Are there plans to extend Celery Bog west to the 231 bypass?
Not right now. There's not. Again, we'd have to determine what the ownership is, but a lot of that stuff, because we often get a lot of questions and challenges about what we do with our park system. And the presumption is that if we put down additional mileage of trail, if we put down additional recreational opportunities, whether it be natural, such as the Celery Bog and extending that, or playground equipment, things of that nature, football fields, softball fields, baseball fields, that they will be utilized, which they are. But the other side of that is it requires maintenance. And when we talk about maintenance, we talk about money. So we, for instance, are in the process of updating the strategic plan for our park system. And part of that is to determine what growth is going to be encouraged by the community and how we can afford to facilitate that growth. Expanding the Celery Bog really hasn't been, as far as I'm aware of, hasn't been, and I met with our park superintendent, Jan Foley, just a little while ago, that really hasn't been pushed that significantly. We feel that there is ample opportunity in the existing footprint of the Celery Bog to enjoy it. The Celery Bog itself has to be very specifically maintained because of the uniqueness of that particular area, and that requires a lot of staff time and a lot of creative uses of some of our support staff, such as the fire department. They do periodic burns there to make sure that some of the invasive plants are easily maintained. So it's not a matter of what we want to do, but it's a matter of what we can do, the practicality of it, and the affordability of it.
If you've got a question for West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis, call it in at 496-1999, email it to ask@wbaa.org, or tweet it at WBAA News on Twitter. Another one comes in from Steven. He says, has the right-of-way been acquired for the State Street project?
Yes.
Okay. And so...
Well, can I give a better answer, too?
Because
I don't
want
to seem glib. That was part of the entire process. When we first started looking at the footprint that the State Street project was going to take, we looked at the land that was private sector, and then we looked at land that was public sector. We looked at land that could be donated, and then we looked at land that we needed to purchase. And when we factor in the cost of the overall project, that's the... some of the items that we look at when we're looking at overall cost. We offer fair market value for private property that we buy. If the seller or the owner doesn't agree with that, then we go into condemnation, and that's a rather involved court process where an external body makes a decision as to the eventual price of that land. We had, with State Street, we had, two parcels that we went to condemnation on. But that's generally how we resolve that.
I wanted to ask you also about the communication that we as a news organization have been having with people regarding State Street. And it seems like a lot of this is being funneled to Purdue people. For instance, our reporter, Chris Marasivica, went out and asked a question of Dave Buck, the city engineer, who's been sitting on the joint board and has been intimately involved in this whole thing.
Yeah, he's our guy.
And he says, no, I can't answer your question. You have to go to this guy over here at Purdue. And it leads to something that I think people have wondered about, which is this now more a Purdue project than it is a City of West Lafayette project? Because it sure seems that Purdue people are doing the communication. Purdue is paying for this thing up front. Are you guys just along for the ride at this point?
Oh, no. This is a city project. This was all based upon a city vision to improve traffic flow and safety.
Well, right. But what I'm asking is, it sure looks like Purdue's in charge right now.
Well, there are certain areas that we do not have authority over. There's a lot of Purdue property that comes into play here. And there's a lot of different components of this project that are specific to developments within the Purdue footprint. And again, this goes back to the conversation that we had when we were talking about the annexation of Purdue. You know, you're bringing in two governmental entities, basically, that operate with the same general goal, which is to make this a great place, a great university, and one of the destination points in the state of Indiana. But they're two separate operating systems. So if Dave were to be asked something specific about something involving some of the facilities at Purdue, or something specific about a project on property that's being governed by the Purdue Research Foundation, he will direct them to go ahead and respond to that. And to be completely honest, within Purdue, there are several different sub-organizations in it as well. Because oftentimes we run into the conflict of who actually owns the land. Is it the Purdue University proper, or is it the business side, which is the Purdue Research Foundation? And those two folks, obviously, they communicate together, but one can't make the decision for the other. And we're no different than that. And it's also a matter of respect. You know, I don't know that Purdue wants us to go ahead and make assumptions on stuff that they're the ones that are responsible for. So out of courtesy, we just go ahead and defer to them. But let there be no doubt, we're all pulling on the same side of the rope when it comes to this project.
A couple of months ago, when there were the questions about the transparency of the project, you had said at a public meeting that when a few months even prior to that, you had asked Dave Buck and other people for some information, they said, Mr. Mayor, we can't give it to you because we've been sworn to secrecy. Has that eased up at all since we're beyond the secrecy of the bidding process?
Yeah. Yeah, it really has. And again, and you sort of asked and answered that in the same sentence. So thank you very much. But the bidding process is a different animal all in and of itself. The bids are all sealed. Nobody can know what the other one's submitting. There can't be certain releases about some of the project components and all that kind of stuff. And the whole purpose of that is just to make sure that the players don't get sued and that somebody doesn't get an unfair advantage. So now that we've made the selection, you know, of the developer, it's all a matter of what we know you'll know when we know it.
So the thing we were asking Dave Buck about that he didn't have an answer to, and quite puzzlingly so, I have to say, is we were looking at the fact that the original timeline that was listed on the State Street website said groundbreaking April of this year. Clearly, we are beyond April. We have not done the groundbreaking. And we eventually got an answer from Don Peterson, who works at Purdue. But my question is, are you taking a different look at the timeline now because you're not going to break ground until at least middle of next month, according to the plans now, could even fall into July. It's possible. So how much have the plans or the timeline for this project changed?
Well, projects are kind of, in some cases, projects, especially ones that are of this size and scope, they have a personality of their own. There are certain things that we know because of the complexity of the actual construction issue are going to take a predictable amount of time, and some things that we don't. The whole process, the speed of the process, the quality of the process, the things that they do within the process is for the most part upon the shoulders of the developer. Plenary Group are the ones that they've been selected as the developer for the project, the contractor for the project. They're the ones that own this. And part of their incentive to generate their own profit on this project is to do it within the allocated timeline. So the first thing that you're going to see probably later this year is the utility relocate. So you'll start seeing you know, some of the roads being barricaded. Hopefully after other roads have been open, citizens, please understand we're going to look at that as well. And then you'll realize that some of these things are starting to happen. That can take a very short period of time, or if there's complications, it could take a longer period of time. When they do their time estimations, and again, I'm speaking somewhat out of my field here because I don't wear a hat of an engineer, but I know a lot of them. But they look at ways to save time. And when they start the project, because we were asked at a public meeting that Chris Marisi-Vissa was actually asked why we do certain things a certain way. Why can't you build the ring road before you start getting into the guts of the project so that way you can defer traffic around and have a greater opportunity for more efficient construction? And the reality of that is because certain components of that project take less time to do. They're simpler to do. You can knock out the easy things more quickly during a given construction season. And then the more complicated ones that might require additional land purchasing, or that might require a little bit more surgical approach to getting things done, take more time. And so they do that when they're mapping these projects out. They do that on that timeline with the understanding is by, you know, sticking to this timeline, giving the things that we can control, we will have the finished project on or near that assumed date.
Well, that's a valid question, though, because the answer we got to that question is some things are set in stone, some things are just going to be the way they're going to be. Mm-hmm. But if you realize that there's a more logical way to do the project, like get the roads that will take the traffic done before you need somewhere to divert them, why not go back and say, especially since the bidding process was done in a way that the people could come back to you and say, no, we think your specs are a little off here. We'd like to change this and then change this over here. Especially since that's the way this whole project has been done from soup to nuts, why not go back and say, isn't it illogical to think that anything is locked in place if you can come up with a more logical way to do it?
Not necessarily. And again, we're getting into something that's challenging for everybody because it is difficult to understand. You know, when you look at a project like this, I mean, if it was a 10 miles of linear road, no big deal. That can be done fairly predictably. But you're doing some components of this project while everything else in life in this city is going on, while it's in progress. And then if you take out one segment, whether it be State Street Central between the river and Grant Street or something on the north or east side, it has an impact on other components. It has an impact on what's going on currently within Purdue University or within the city or what's going to be going on with that particular project. So if you shut down a road, then that's got to, the traffic on that road's got to go somewhere, as we're experiencing now all throughout Greater Lafayette. So what we try and do is we try and minimize the adverse impact and do as much as we can while it's relatively, and I'm going to use the term harmless, but relatively, it doesn't have the overall negative impact that it could have. So to reroute traffic means you have to close something down and make sure something else is open. But you also need to make sure that what that connects to isn't going to be adversely impacted as well. So that's why we can pick certain segments, get those done, and do other segments and reroute to the newer segments and have sort of that leapfrog approach to getting as much project done as we can with a minimal amount of adverse impact.
We talked about the beginning of this project being delayed by a couple of months from the timeline that was originally on the website. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it stand to reason also that the end of it is now going to get pushed from December of 18 into the beginning of 2019? Because it seems unlikely you're going to make up 2 or 3 months in the course of construction.
I don't know. I mean, there's a possibility that we could have a very dry, very cool summer and we can get a lot of work done. Of course, the other side is applicable as well. We could have a very horrible, you know, seasonal year and it could really drag things out.
Are you telling me there are 2 or 3 months of delays baked into this timeline to begin with?
I don't think so. Well,
how are you going to make up 2 or 3 months?
I don't know. I'm not an engineer, but I can tell you that when things are done, they're done in a way that allows for you to do things in a practical, best-case scenario way. And there are days that when construction folks, you'll see them working at night. You know, if there is an absolute drop-dead deadline, you're going to see a lot of activity happening beyond the scope of the 8 to 10 to 12-hour day.
Let me get back to a listener question. Josh has written in and says, does the city have any influence over somewhat private roadways? For example, he says the access road in front of the new Menards/Meyer has a strange intersection where only 3 sides have to stop. Is this something the city can change or is it up to the property owners?
The property owners of that particular intersection, the private property owners around that intersection?
I believe that's what he's asking.
Well, I think that road, I believe that's in the county and it's two state roads, so we don't have much to do with that. But as a general rule, usually if a road requires, especially if it's a signalized intersection, electric signalized intersection, it requires what's called a warrant. And what that warrant is it's a research product done by engineers who are responsible for that roadway to make a determination as to the safety of that particular roadway. So a request would need to be made to NDOT. They would have to come down and do their research and make a determination if there needs to be something altered about that intersection.
We've got just about 10 minutes left with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis today on Ask the Mayor here on WBAA. You can call in your questions at area code 765-496-1999. You can email them to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Another one comes in from Chris, who says, traffic lights at a few intersections in town, if not several, have long waits for the light to change, even when there is no traffic which has the green light. This is not a problem if one has the right turn lane. One example is at Salisbury and Navajo. Is there a plan to adjust these so the light changes quicker so that traffic moves better?
Again, that's one of those things all the lights are looped. And that means when you pull up to the intersection, you'll see little grooves like a circle or whatever the shape is within the concrete. And that's usually what starts the signalization process. The loops serve one purpose, and then the timing of the light serves another. We have a light engineer that works for our street department, and that's why oftentimes you'll see them going into the cages or the lockers to make adjustments to those lights. In the city of West Lafayette, because of our population shift, oftentimes what we'll do is we'll go ahead and remove the looping and go ahead to manual. So the quick answer is yes, we can make adjustments. The other side of that answer is that, you know, we do so when the traffic flow warrants that. You know, there are certain peak times when that traffic needs to go through because we need to make sure that the traffic at 52 and Salisbury doesn't back up to the intersection at Navajo and Salisbury, which eventually backs up to the intersection at Salisbury and Lindbergh. We got to be really careful about that. And with what's going on now community-wide with the construction projects, the volume of traffic is much higher. And it's much higher during off-peak times than it used to be. So there's a lot of adjustments going on with those lights right now. But during for instance, after 8 or 9 o'clock at night, usually what that defaults to then is the signaling of the traffic loops or the sensors that are below the concrete level. And that's usually what dictates that. And as always, the lights are prone to failure. I mean, nothing lasts forever. And sometimes when the system does fault, you know, we usually end up getting some folks that let us know that they sat through four different phases of a light. And as a motorcycle guy, I know exactly what they're talking about because oftentimes when I'm on my bike, I can't trip that trigger no matter how much I jump up and down on it. But I think the state recently enacted a law that lets me run it.
Okay.
I think. And if there's a policeman out there, if I'm wrong, please let me know because I don't need another ticket.
I wanted to spend our last few minutes talking about a lawsuit that the city recently settled with a man who was tased by city police in 2013. He was taping another police encounter at Chauncey Hill Mall. And I wanted to ask you what the police policy is, if any, about police being filmed, especially in this age where everyone's got a video camera in their pocket now.
Well, and the police officers have video cameras on their uniforms.
Correct.
So I think that there is no restrictions. I mean, we can't impose on people's constitutional rights. So, you know, if people choose to film police action, police activity, it's absolutely fine. The only thing that I think that would create any sort of a restriction is if they were in some way interfering with whatever activity is going on.
What is that definition of interference, both from your point of view as somebody who oversees the West Lafayette Police Department and as somebody who used to be a cop yourself?
Well, I don't know that they both meet. back in my day, we didn't have that technology. I mean, back in my day, if you were involved in the news business back then, cameras weighed like 50 pounds. And if you were being filmed, it was obvious.
Well, right. But so there is body cam video that's been released. And mm-hmm. the officers clearly say that the person who they eventually tase has been initiating contact mm-hmm. is the term that they use. What would you define that phrase to mean?
Well, each police officer has their own circle of what they believe to be threat. You know, if they cross that certain threshold, then the threat potential on the perception of the officer increases. And not to dodge, because we can get into much detail about this as you want, that basically is a case-by-case assessment. Now, quite clearly, the level of force that can be used is relatively objective, but the opportunity to use force is somewhat subjective. So in a real live police situation, and again, going back to my days when I actually was on the street and I was a commander on the street, that was really subjective to the opinion of the officer.
So the officer can decide if I'm sitting across a desk from you, this sort of distance, whether I'm initiating contact, if I'm videotaping you, or if I'm half a block down the sidewalk and if I'm taking video of you. I mean, you could make an argument that there's some contact there.
You could make an argument that about the contact, but also there would have to be something that would have to take it to that next level to sort of identify the potential threat. And a lot of that has to do with the circumstances that are going on. You know, if there's a crowd around, if it's a situation where there's a lot of different activity going on, all those kind of things are sort of taken into consideration.
We should say that this is something that takes place in 2013, before anybody knows about what happens in Ferguson, before Eric Garner, before Laquan McDonald, before any of the recent talk in the last couple of years about community policing, about excessive use of violence. However, this is a topic you and I have talked about on this program. How does this incident affect how your police force going forward is going to view the community policing model? And we've talked about getting away from the old baton method of policing. So how does this impact the way that you're going to instruct Chief Domkowski to instruct his people to do their jobs going forward?
Well, to be honest, I wouldn't instruct the chief on how to train his people because I'm not qualified to do so. The general guidelines I give all of my department heads is to make sure they understand who they are and what they do. You know, they're public servants. Law enforcement's no different. It just so happens that some of the service that they provide is through an intervening process. It's very closely regulated by constitutional law. And each officer is trained in defensive tactics. And the defensive tactics that they're trained by is up to date in what that use of force continuum allows for. And when it comes to the situation involving somebody that's combative, somebody that's verbally threatening, whatever the circumstances may be, it empowers that officer to take certain steps to prevent themselves from being hurt or prevent, in some cases, the offending citizen from injuring themselves.
Now, it seems like there's a line here between offending and annoying.
The
police may have been annoyed by the person who was holding the cell phone camera, but there seems little evidence from the body camera video that he was a threat in any way. Isn't there some sort of redefinition of what a potential threat should be from any of us, myself included, who have a cell phone and can shoot a video of anything we want?
Yeah. I mean, you could always ask if there could be a further interpretation. But I think what needs to be understood is this case was not adjudicated. There was a settlement made. So what that means is that the insurance company and the individual came to an agreement. You know, we were not necessarily involved in that negotiation.
But let's be honest, even though the city doesn't admit fault, the insurance company says, don't take this to trial, you're not going to win.
And why do you think they do that? What do you think their motivation is?
Well, save money,
There you go.
Save all sorts of hassle.
Well, no, the insurance companies are in business, and they're in business to generate revenue. So what they do is they make a business decision about what they believe to be the shortest course of action to take that's going to save everybody some money.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks, as always, though. And we'll look forward to doing it again next month.
Thanks so much, Stan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to tune in next week for our program with Lafayette Mayor Tony Brzezworski. And you can find all of these programs archived at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.
Support for Ask the Mayor on WBAA comes from your membership and Butler, Fairman & Seifert, a civil engineering firm providing communities with professional expertise and guidance. Butler, Fairman & Seifert, civil engineering solutions for better communities. BFSENGR.com. And Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.